Jack's gonna crack your brain. Jack Box is a man and he's got a plan. And a souped up 90 style passenger van. So when you're craving barbecue that's spicy or sweet, he's gonna drive through a wall and give your taste buds a treat.
Try my barbecue bacon cheeseburger combo with sweet or spicy barbecue sauce topped with bacon and onion rings. Plus fries and a drink for just $4.99.
Jack, I love you.
Okay. Only a Jack in the Box. Small fries and small drinks. Limited time only. Price and participation may vary.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Batman Report. We go live every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and check in on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, recaps, previews, interviews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres, and every week I'm alongside my co-host Fred Alvader. Fred, hi, how are you today?
Carlos, I'm excited. It's Memorial Week here in the great state of Ohio, which means the best golfers in the world will descend on Jack Nicklaus's Muirfield Village to vie for the big check. We have Memorial Tournament Director Dan Sullivan talking about this year's tournament. Plus, we're only 2 weeks away from the U.S. Open at Erin Hills. I'm really looking forward to that. But first tonight, Shen-Chen Fan won the LPGA Volvic Classic. We're up the road here in Ann Arbor. Kevin Kisner tamed Colonial. And surprise of all surprises, Bernhard Langer won again. Let's talk some golf, Carlos. Let's go.
Let's go. And as usual, every week we start with a weekend action. And Fred, there was action on the PGA Tour, and you have the information about it. Let us know about it.
Yeah, it was the last time that the now Dean and DeLuca Championship will be held at historic Colonial Golf Club in Fort Worth, Texas. Jordan Spieth made some noise on Sunday as he rallied, but fell one shot short. Kevin Kisner used accuracy off the tee and a marvelous short game to win for the last time at Colonial. Colonial held its final PGA Tour event Sunday. Next year it's going to be moved to the Coeur Crenshaw-designed Trinity Forest Golf Club. It went out with a fitting winner. However, Kevin Kisner was steady down the stretch, although he had Jordan Spieth, Sean O'Hare, and John Rahm breathing down his neck. He began the day in third spot, but a splendid 66 on Sunday was good enough for the win. Kisner only found the fairway 50% of the time and hit only 67% of greens regulation, but his amazing short game and putting kept him one shot clear at the end. On Sunday, he managed 10 pars, 6 birdies, and 2 bogeys to post his 4-under par round. Jordan Spieth, who struggled in the first round with a double, 2 bogeys, and 4 birdies to keep his round together, found himself well back of the leaders on Sunday, but his final round, 65, was second only to Steve Stricker's 63 as the best rounds of the day. Spieth returned to his old putter this week, and even though he lifted out several putts on Sunday, managed a runner-up finish and looks like he's trending in the right direction with the U.S. Open coming up in 2 weeks. Sean O'Hare has been on tour for a long time. His last win came in 2011, but he is a constant performer and his runner-up was his best for a long time. It seems like every week we talk about John Rahm. He's not missed a cut in his 14 starts this year and has a win, 2 runners up, and a third, plus 7 top tens. He's only finished outside the top 25 4 times. He's earned $4.4 million, risen to number 9 in the world ranking, and number 4 in the FedEx Cup. To say he has taken the PGA Tour by storm is an understatement. Another fiery Spaniard. This guy is going to be a real problem for the Americans in future Ryder Cups, Carlos. I don't like the looks of this at all. Webb Simpson, you remember him, former U.S. Open champion, had a very good week. We haven't heard much from him for a while. He had scores of 68, 66, 67 the first 3 rounds, which earned him the 54-hole lead, but he appeared nervous and fidgety on Sunday and could not make anything happen. His 1-over-par 71 moved him down to 5th place. We've been mentioning Paul Casey often of late. He was in a position to win, but a final round 73 left him with a T10. Former winner at Fort Worth and a part-time regular tour player now, Steve Stricker, as I mentioned, posted the low round of the day, a 63, to move up 25 spots to T7. Carlos, I find it hard to believe the USGA is not going to issue Stricker an exemption into the U.S. Open at Erin Hills. He is still very competitive and is Mr. Wisconsin. The USGA has only issued 52 special exemptions in the past 50 years, but it seems Stricker is certainly deserving of one this year. Looking at the leaderboard from the old Colonial and seeing all the irons and hybrids the guys had to hit off the tees to the tight fairways at Colonial makes the point why the tour has to move from this iconic venue. It's sad, but with the modern ball and equipment, these great old courses are now just too short for the modern game. I am looking, however, forward to seeing Trinity Forest next year for the Dean DeLuca. I've seen the pictures. The course looks fantastic. Carlos, Dean DeLuca, Kevin Kisner played the best last week, tremendous short game. He looks like a pretty steady guy. You know, he's got two wins now with pairing up there for the Zurich Classic and the team deal with Scott Brown. So he's having a pretty good year.
He does. And I think we haven't seen the last of him. I think that he keeps improving. And this is just going to help his confidence going forward. And he's really a good player. I think that more than anything is confidence that he was lacking. And now he's finally learning how to close the deal. So definitely he'll be there. And, of course, I have to mention John Rahm. I mean, Rookie of the Year, definitely. They're going to have to kill him for him to lose that. I mean,
he's
amazing. He's going up already to number 9 in the world. He just becomes the fifth player in history to achieve the top 10 in the World Golf Rankings before turning 23. So, you know, it's an incredible achievement, and like I have always said, the sky's the limit with him. If he just can, as soon as he matures a little bit more, we're really going to see his big ascend through the rankings. He's the real deal. He has every tool to look for. Hey, let's talk a bit about the European Tour, where Alex Noren, he went into his final round of the BMW PGA Championship, hoping to play well so he could start next week on a high, and came out of it with what he later reckoned was probably his best performance ever over 18 holes, a West Course record of 62, and enough to win the tournament by 2 strokes. Yeah, sweet, who completed his round just before the heavens opened, a little after 3 p.m., began his day 7 shots off the lead, but on an exhilarating afternoon in which player after player made birdies and the course record of 66 was equaled by Pablo Larrazábal and then broken by Dean Burmester soon after, Noren then finished with an eagle 3 to set the target. He had picked up 6 shots in his last 7 holes and then sat around as an hour or more of heavy rain helped douse the challenges of a half a dozen or so live contenders back then. The challenges came from Shane Lowry, Henrik Stenson, Brandon Grace, and the overnight leader, Andrew Dodd, but they fizzled out during the downpour, which should not have affected the performances of players of this quality. But that and scoreboard pressure had their effect as the birdies dried up, and Noren's lead, which the Swede thought was catchable just after he finished and he was ready for a playoff, began to look more and more unassailable. Stenson did pick up a shot at the 18th to finish at 8-under and a tie for third, but bogeys at the 9th, 13th, and the inexplicable 1 or 15th had already put the skids under his chances after a strong start with 6 birdies up until the 12th. It looked like he had it, but no, he couldn't. He couldn't close the deal. Lowry was another to eagle the last, but double bogeys at the 15th and 17th had done it for him, and he finished at 7-under after picking up 4 shots on the front line from 9 and after only 11 putts for that stretch. Hideo Tanihara, his playing partner, also picked up 4 on the front 9, but after playing through the rain, his putt lipped out and the last and cost him a share of second as Francesco Molinari sailed past him soon after with a birdie-birdie finish for 68 and 9-under. Nicholas Kolsert, who finished halfway through the downpour with a 65 for an 8-under finish, was another to wonder what might have been as he hit out of bounds at the 15th and made double bogey, though a share for third place with Stenson and Sonny Hada is probably not his biggest disappointment. Lowry, Grace, and Dot had shared the lead at 9-under at the turn, but they were to be joined by Norrie, who peeled off 3 birdies in 4 holes from the 12th, had a great up and down to save par at 15, and with the threatened rain in the air, fired a 5-iron to leave himself that 3-footer for the clubhouse lead. Burmester had made birdie at the last for 65 to set the early target of 6-under with his course record. The South African said at the time that he felt he was a couple of shots short, but would be hanging on around in readiness for the downpour, and he was hoping it opened the door for him. 40 minutes or so later, Norris finished meant he was free to carry on his day. He could just go. It was over. And the most fleeting of records had gone. That victory earned Norris 1,041,940 points and catapulted him from 26th to 4th position in the Race to Dubai rankings and from 13th to 8th in the world rankings as he's recapturing that stunning form from last season when he won 4 tournaments in 4 months. Other notable finishes were Justin Rose and Matt Fitzpatrick were T12, Thomas Peters and Lee Westwood, whose challenge faded after he teed off in the penultimate group, finished at T14. Lee has played this turn 24 times without winning it. Wow. Beef Johnson, he finished at T21. American Peter Uihlein finishing a crowded T30 with Tyrell Hatton, Andy Sullivan, and Bernd Wiesberger, among others. Ian Poulter was a T40, Ernie Els and Alexander Levy, T51. Danny Willett, who continues to fall down the rankings, got a T58, and Luke Donald was 65th. Fred among the miscut, surprisingly, was Tommy Fleetwood, Russell Knox, Martin Keimer, Eduardo Molinari, and last week's winner, Alvaro Quiroz.
Yeah, this was the first stop in the new Rolex series. So they had a big purse, they had a great field. Of course, this has always been one of the premier events on the European Tour, the BMW PGA. So, did you see Ernie Els called a penalty on himself for an improper draw?
Yeah.
It was wet there. He took a draw. You know, he tried to identify the ball, and then he took a drop, and he felt bad about it because it wasn't in the hole anymore, and he ended up calling a penalty. And then there was some grouching because Brendan Grace did the same thing, and he didn't call a penalty on himself. So there was a little going back and forth on that deal, but they'll work it all out, I'm sure. Hey, Carlos, the Champions Tour had their second consecutive major championship last week, the KitchenAid Senior PGA at Trump National. You know, and there was more talk about the opulent Trump National course, the fancy clubhouse, and the sexist Champions Tour players, and they talked about the actual play at the PGA Senior Championship. We're going to discuss in detail the fallout from USA Today's Christine Brennan's article about Rocco Medin and Fred Funk being sexist, but they support President Trump, and in our practice range section this evening, a little bit later on here. Trump finally got to host a major at one of his gaudy courses, but had more important things on his mind last week. He was in Europe meeting with world leaders, and thank goodness was not able to add to the media circus that broke out at the Senior PGA. Ho-hum, Bernhard Langer wins again. This was Langer's second consecutive major championship title in as many weeks. He won the Regent's Tradition last week to tie Jack Nicklaus with 8 senior titles. And many feel he set a new senior major championship record with 9 this week. But Gary Player says, not so fast, my friends. Player counts 9 senior majors, kind of unofficially. In his senior tour career, Player won the senior PGA championship 3 times, 1986, 1988, and 1990. He won the U.S. Senior Open twice in 1987 and 1988, and the Senior Players Championship once in 1987. But he also won the Senior British Open 3 times in 88, 90, and 97. However, back then, the Senior British was not deemed a major. It wasn't deemed a major until 2003. player Hall of Fields. Those three should count along with his six others to make 9 senior major titles for the South African. Well, that argument makes for great post-round discussions in the 19th hole, but nonetheless, Longer is now recognized as the official career senior majors leader after passing Nicklaus's mark of 8 senior major championship titles. Could someone please inform Bernhard Langer that he's 59 years old? He's not supposed to be beating guys nearly 10 years younger than he is. Langer began the final round 1 stroke behind 54 leader Vijay Singh, but his 400 par 68 was 2 better than Singh's Sunday round and gave Langer another senior major title. Our favorite Champions Tour player, Miguel Angel Jimenez, had another great finish. T3 with Billy Andrade, but they were not a factor and finished 5 shots behind Lahner. Lahner now leads the Charles Schwab Cup with 1.66 million more than double. Second place name on the list, Scotty McCarron, with a measly 784,000. So, Carlos, you're talking about John Rahm having the Rookie of the Year locked up on the PGA Tour. I think it's pretty safe to say that Bernhard Langer has the Charles Schwab Cup safely in hand barely a halfway through the season on the Champions Tour.
Totally agree. I mean, they're going to have to do whoever is going to take it away from him. He's going to have to win like 5 tournaments, the rest of the majors, and all top 10 or something like that to take it away from Bernhard. We can safely say he's going to be the Charles Schwab Cup champion one more time. Hey, let's talk a little bit about the LPGA, where Sean Chong Fong didn't look at the scoreboard all week at the LPGA Volvic Championship until she was on the 18th green in the final round on Sunday. That's when she was able to breathe a sigh of relief, knowing she only had a 2-2 putt from about 10 feet to secure the second annual Volvic Championship at Travis Point Peak Country Club in Ann Arbor in Michigan. The China native tapped in the second putt to finish 4 under par for the round and 19 under for the tournament, beating out Min Jae Lee and Sung Hyun Park, who both finished at 18 under. Playing just a couple of groups ahead of Fong, Lee knew she needed a strong finish to catch the leader, and after her birdie at number 17, she tried to reach the green on the par 5 18-2, but she missed well to the left and ended up near the scoring tent before scrambling to make par. But Fong, she had still room for error as she was finishing her round. Not that she necessarily realized it, but she says that she tries to ignore the leaderboard when she plays because it would give her unnecessary pressure. So Fong now ranked number 7 in the world, bogeying the 16th and 18th holes, but had a 4-stroke lead with 4 holes to play. The victory was Fong's 3rd since winning the bronze medal last year's Olympics. She has quite a streak going after that, riding now what it's a hot streak with 11 top 10 finishes in 15 events since then. Chonchon, she won in Malaysia and Japan during an impressive stretch toward the end of the 2016 season. On American soil, however, it had been a while since her last victory. Fong led by 1 stroke over Lisette Salas and 2 over Suzanne Pedersen heading into Sunday, and she said she doesn't know how she will celebrate the win, but she might use some of the $195,000 she won on Sunday to go shopping yesterday. What she might shop for, I don't know what she did, but I hope she did what she said, because she said smiling, "I don't know yet, but that was a big check. I can buy something, but I'm not going to spend it all." I hope she did it. Lisette Salas with a 69 and Young On Lee, 67, finished tied for 4th, 2 strokes behind. It was another great outing for who I have said already is going to be also the Rookie of the Year here, Sung Hyun Park, who finished in 3rd place. Lydia Ko, the world's number 1, she skipped this event but remains number 1 in the Rolex rankings. Soyeon Ryu and Arya Yutanagan each could have displaced her this week, but Ryu with a 72 finishing attack for 56 at 3 under, and Yutanagan with a 71, and she was the defending champion at this event, was 11 under and tied for 21st. Ryu had finished in the top 10 in 11 consecutive events dating to last season. That streak ended this past week. Other notable finishes: Suzanne Pedersen, T6 with Moria Yutanagan, Arya's sister. Nelly Korda, T9, with her older sister Jessica on a T11. Stacey Lewis was 16. Brooke Henderson, also T21 with Aria Itanagan. Charlie Hall, T48. And like I mentioned, Soyeon and Rhea, bad outing there. Rare bad outing with a T56. Likewise for Lexi Thompson with a T65, while Fred Michelle Wee missed the cut.
Yeah, you know, I feel really bad. This is a really good event, and I'm not that far from it, and I did not get the chance to get up there. I have been so busy the last couple of weeks. I did get to go to the media day and, you know, been involved with their press and stuff and trying to do some promotion for it. But it's a really good event. Travis Point is a wonderful golf course. It's in a great area there of Ann Arbor, and really a good tournament. Hey, Carlos, I want to talk just a minute about the NCAAs. The women tournament wrapped up last week. Arizona State defeated Northwestern last week to take the NCAA Division I Women's Championship. But in kind of a side note here, they had some more rules problems there. Did you know there was a penalty for going potty in the NCAA Women's Tournament? I'm sure you didn't know this, but don't ride, if you're in the NCAAs, don't ride a golf cart to the restroom. Northwestern Sarah Cho and Kent State's Kelly Nielsen, playing in the same group, received a two-shot penalty at Rich Harvest Farms for taking a cart ride to the bathroom. Rules state, a player must not ride on any form of transportation during a stipulated round unless authorized. Going to the restroom, apparently, is not automatically authorized. The penalties really didn't have any impact on the overall proceedings, but it's good to know it's a penalty if you try to ride a cart to the restroom. The men's competition will hold their championship match tomorrow. They had the semifinals today, and they just wrapped up not 15 minutes ago. Number 2 Oklahoma defeated Illinois to make it, and so Oklahoma will be in the finals, and they will face defending champion Oregon Ducks. Oregon played Vanderbilt today, and they had a tremendous match. They were down the first four matches, ended up 2-2. Vanderbilt won 2. Oregon won 2. The final match was on the court. One of the matches even went into extra holes where a kid from Vanderbilt drained a putt from off the green to make birdie to win the hole, to win the match. Then the last match was on the course, and the Oregon kid ended up winning 2-up. On the 17th for the win, and that gave Oregon the win. Casey Martin, remember him, the golfer that had the bad leg, that had all the lawsuits about using a cart on tour? He's the coach at Oregon, so it's great to see Casey Martin still doing well out there, doing something he likes to do. Tomorrow we've got OU versus OU for the final. We got Oregon versus Oklahoma. When you think of Oklahoma, you sure don't think of much golf. But evidently they got a pretty good golf team out there because they're going to be in the finals. I wouldn't bet against Oregon, though. They seem to have a real powerhouse. They've got the experience they did last year, the defending champs. So that's good stuff. If anybody has missed that, they may want to set their DVR for tomorrow afternoon and tape that and then watch it when they get home or something because it's really good stuff. They're playing at Rich Harvest Farms out here in Illinois. And it's really the match play. They show a lot of emotion. The kids do. They want to play, and it's really good stuff, Carlos.
It really is, and it's great to see how these future stars get their start in the golf scene. Basically, a lot of them we get to see them afterwards in the pros, and it's good to just see and compare the before and afters with them. And with that, we'll wrap up the Weekend Backspin. Now, we're going to go for our four call, which is quick previews of this next weekend's tournament. And Fred, we have the Memorial right in your backyard. We can almost say that. And we're going to change a little bit our format today. We're going to go with our VIG because it's related to the Memorial Tournament which is this weekend, and we're going to preview it coming afterwards. So, Fred, tell us a little bit about your interview with Dan Sullivan.
Yeah, Dan Sullivan just does a remarkable job as a tournament director for the Memorial every year. He's been doing it for several years now. Every detail to make the event bigger and better is studied and attended to. Over $25 million has been donated to charity from the event. I mean, it's just, it's fantastic. And we want to thank him again for taking a few minutes to talk to us. When we were down there last month for the Legends Lunch, and Dan was kind enough to talk to us for a minute. We taped this interview for playing tonight. So go ahead and roll it, Carlos. It's short, but he covers a lot of good stuff.
Absolutely.
We're talking with Dan Sullivan here at the Legends Luncheon in Columbus, Ohio, prior to the start of the Memorial Tournament next month. Dan, another successful Legends Luncheon, $1.2 million for charity.
Yeah, we're really proud of what's happened over the last 7 years, and this today is a culmination of what we've been working on. To be able to have Jack Nicklaus come in with Greg Norman and provide some entertainment to a room full of 750 people and raise $1.2 million for Nationwide Children's Hospital takes a lot of hard work, and it's really satisfying and gratifying to know that people respond so well. They respond well to kind of our message of being a part of the community, and Jack and Barbara's expectation on the tournament keep on growing from a competitive standpoint, but also grow from a philanthropic standpoint. So couldn't be happier with the results today and look forward to keep on growing.
I think this is the 41st year.
42nd
year, mm-hmm, for the Memorial, yeah, since 1976.
That's right.
Keeps getting bigger every year. Yeah. What's the total dollars raised for charity for the tournament?
It's over $25 million to this point. It's been a labor of love for everyone. You know, we have over 3,500 volunteers that come be a part of the event. They all represent a charity. We ensure that charities are recognized throughout the week of the tournament and financially afterwards. We have thousands of fans that come out and make it a part of their annual rite of passage from spring into summer, and use it as a place to enjoy friends and bring back family together and just really be part of, celebrate the fact that Columbus has this great asset. And so we're really thankful and appreciative that everyone reacts so well to it.
For people that have come to the memorial in the past, what's maybe something they want to look for this year that hasn't been around before?
Well, we do have a couple of new ideas, but we're going to hold off on announcing those for a couple of weeks, so we'll tease a little bit. But our focus is to make sure that we continue to provide a golf experience second to none for the players as well as the people who are watching the golf. But if they're just out to hang out and they just like the environment, we're going to give them a couple chances to do some things unique this year that haven't been offered in the past. And as I said, in the next couple of weeks, we'll be offering those up.
How much do you draw from going to other tournaments, seeing what they're doing? For example, the Masters and all the stuff they,
yeah,
do, or maybe the Waste Management Phoenix Open,
yeah,
and how they interact with the crowds. How much do you draw from other tournaments like that?
Yeah, we're always paying attention. The good news is about the industry, we share a lot of information. So annually we get together twice a year, called best practices. So tournament directors like myself and staff will share information about what we're doing, and then those other tournaments around the country will give their kind of their best and what they're offering, and we share all ideas all the time. And it's a natural process because we're all in different markets. We all have the same goal of putting on a great quality product and supporting the community and charity. And so we do a lot of it. I'll personally go to 3 or 4 tournaments a year and talk to the directors, my counterparts, and learn a little bit more and bring some ideas back, and then also share what we have.
If you were coming to the memorial for the first time,
yeah,
and you're gonna park yourself someplace and want to see the most action,
yeah,
where would that be?
For me, I love number 12, par 3. A lot of risk-reward going on there, and a nice big crowd builds there. And spend part of the day watching number 12 and then walk around the golf course. The front side gets somewhat overlooked by the fans, but back on 5 and 6, really good par 5, really good par 4, plenty of places to sit and view, and fun to see golfers think through their shots, which you don't necessarily get on all golf courses, but at Muirfield Village you do.
That's the thing. They can't just bomb away. It is receptive to long hitters, but they got to keep it in play around here.
Yeah, absolutely. They got to pick their spots out of the fairway and into the greens and figure out which side they want to be on. And you're right, it is open. They can go at it, but if they go at it in the wrong spot, they're going to be penalized for it. And I think that's what Jack ultimately had in mind when he created it.
Dan, thank you so much for taking a few minutes talking to us.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
There you have it. That was Dan Sullivan, the tournament director for the Memorial Tournament. And I love that final insight there about where you can be the 12 and, of course, people overlook that front nine a lot of the times. And like he was mentioning, this in Mirfield Village, it was designed by Jack Nicklaus, and it's definitely every design from Jack Nicklaus is like he was thinking about himself and his style of play. So it's a risk-reward type of play, and really rewards precision. So great insight there, Frank.
Yeah, if you're back there on 12, you can see, you know, that 12 is such an iconic par 3. You know, it's similar to number 12 at Augusta National, you know, all over water. It's the green's a little bit angled away from you, and it's a pretty scary shot. The tee is up on the hill, and you're hitting downhill to it. But if you're back in that area, you can 11 green is right there, which 11 is a par 5. So you see the guys that try to come in there on their second shot, try to maneuver into that green. If they miss it, they get some fantastic, different, odd-looking or really difficult chip shots that they may have to pull off. So that's always exciting. And then you got number 12, the par 3. And if you want to walk over, you can walk over right there. You're right in the middle of the fairway, halfway down the hole on number 13, so you can see the approach shots into 13. So that's a really good area back in there. You kind of see three holes for the price of one back in there. That's what he's talking about. And there's a couple of those spots like that. I love to watch number 14. It's a great hole, a little short par 4. But you really have to lay up there because there's just nothing to hit to up by the green. And then even with a wedge in your hand, you got the creek that runs along all the length of the green on the right-hand side. You got a big bunker on the left. It's a long, narrow green. To get that ball back in there when they put the Sunday pin placement clear back to the back, it's really, you got to have nerves of steel to throw that ball back in there because everything slopes down into that ditch. And then the green is just, it's like lightning, and it breaks really hard left to right down towards the water. So, but there are some great holes to watch on that golf course, but those are probably some of the best holes.
And like you were saying, we have the Memorial Tournament this weekend. It's going to be there in Mirfield Village Golf Club in Dublin, Ohio, with an $8.7 million purse. So, Fred, you have the preview of what we're going to see this week.
Yeah, although Rory McIlroy is going to be missing, it looks to boast a very strong field this year. You know, they had some problems in the past couple of years with some events going on in Europe that some of the European guys didn't show up at the Memorial. But that's not really the case this year. Everything's kind of falling in line for Jack. But Rory has continuing complications from his rib injury, forced him to withdraw, and he issued this statement. It's disappointing to miss the Memorial Tournament. This tournament attracts such a stellar field, and I was excited to try and better my fourth place finish from last year. The Memorial Tournament is one of the best tour stops of the year, and I hope everyone involved has a great week. Some of the top names in the field, just pretty much everybody is there. You got 7 of the top 10 in the world golf ranking. You got Dustin Johnson, Jason Day, Hideki, Jordan Spieth, Adam Scott, Justin Rose, Ricky Fowler. It also boasts all 10 of the top 10 in the FedEx Cup point standings. So, and then in addition, you've got 7 past winners to the Memorial Tournament are returning, coming back. Jack said, I'm pleased and excited to welcome so many of the game's top players from Mirfield Village Golf Club, and I look forward to a great week of competition that the fans of Central Ohio will enjoy. The best players in the world have always supported the Memorial Tournament, and certainly this year is no different. So, Carlos, it's going to be a great week. I looked at the weather. There seems like it always rains and all that kind of stuff during the Memorial. They are calling for some rain on Friday and Saturday. So we'll see how that plays out. Hopefully they'll be able to get all in on Sunday. But always have a little rain in Columbus for the Memorial.
I certainly hope that it doesn't. I'm sorry. Yes, I certainly hope that it doesn't rain and it's a great tournament because, I mean, the last 3 years have been decided in a playoff, and before that it had only 4 playoffs in its previous 38 years, and those last 3 winners, as a coincidence, earned their first PGA Tour victory there at Memorial. William McGirt, who's the defending champion, David Lindmarth from the year before, Hideki Matsuyama. So definitely, like you said, it's a great field. The only three that are not playing from the top ten is Rory because he decided to pull out to get his rib injury. Another week of rest ahead of the U.S. Open. And also because Henrik Stenson and Alex Noren are out playing their homeland. So that's why they're not playing this week. Otherwise, I would be sure that they would be there. One person that I really like to see what's going on is Bubba Watson. He has not finished in the top 10 in stroke play on the PGA Tour since the Tour Championship last September. He comes in the Memorial number 124 in the FedEx Cup, and he's number 32 in the President's Cup standings. He just keeps falling and falling and falling. I don't know what's wrong with Bubba. But I also have a question for you and what's your take. I don't know if you heard Jack talking in the news conference a few days before the start of the Memorial Golf last week when he was asked about the possibility, you know, that the PGA Tour is considering the concept of moving the PGA Championship from August to May, and it's gaining a little traction, even though there are so many other pieces of the puzzle that Commissioner Jay Monahan should be believed when he says that it's not a done deal. But Jack was asked, and he says that he is willing to move his tournament, the Memorial Tournament, if it would mean moving the Players' Championship from May back to March, and slotting the PGA Championship somewhere there in May. That also means that two other PGA Tour events would have to vacate their spot to allow for the Tour Championship to end around Labor Day. So what would be your take on this tournament being moved?
You know, it would be great if the Memorial could be more towards, you've already got the U.S. Open in the middle of June. And Jack, I don't think, wants to be the week before the U.S. Open. He likes being 2 weeks before because the guys come in for their kind of final tune-up before, except for the guys who go play in Texas, but they come in for their final tune-up before the U.S. Open. Plus, the USGA holds, for the guys that play in the Memorial, they hold U.S. Open sectionals right there in Columbus and in Ohio, so they have a lot of they can handle a lot of players trying to qualify for the U.S. Open there. So I just don't see, and they're not going to change, the U.S. Open is not going to change from a Father's Day finish, so it's always going to be in the middle of June because that's their historical spot. I don't see them moving the USGA. I don't see that happening. And, you know, Jack may say that, but I just don't see him wanting to move from 2 weeks before the U.S. Open. I think he might get in trouble with scheduling and lose some of the top players that he wants. And then it's pretty dicey if you go after the U.S. Open. Where do you go? Because guys take some time off before they have to go over and play in the Open Championship. It gets pretty tough, and you can't go any earlier. You just can't go earlier than the last week in May in Columbus. You just can't do it. The weather gets way too iffy. The golf course would be way too soft in May. I don't know where he would go. And you can't go in Columbus. You don't want to go after August 1st because now you get into football season in Ohio, and you know what football season is like up here. I mean, it reigns supreme. So I don't know where he would go. I don't know where it would work. He's got the perfect spot right now. I just can't see him moving across.
Well, he has met already with Monahan and other two officials. That was in Tuesday morning. And he has said that he also talked to PGA of America, about a potential move. And, you know, move the PGA Championship to May already is a risky proposal, though, because you allow so many other northern golf courses to be back in May up of the weather. So suddenly the Memorial could be squeezed between the PGA Championship and the U.S. Open. He said that, and I'm just going to quote him, he said, because the Memorial Tournament would be the only tournament day the PGA could have to promote in there in the middle, so it would be probably better for us, in a sense. Now, by saying that, he's ignoring really the tournaments before and after his own. Let's talk about it. Colonial last week, you know, which dates to 1946, and it's a shrine to Ben Hogan. And the FedEx St. Jude Classic, which is sponsored by the same company, shelling out all the money for the FedEx Cup. But who knows where any tournament is going to wind up, but definitely it's a this is like he says, this is Jay's problem. Referring to Jay Monahan, right? But I really, like you, I don't see where they can put it. And if it's between the U.S. Open and the PGA, I don't know. That could spell problems for him. I don't see it like he says that it would be the best thing, because there are going to be some players and maybe some of the top players that would like to take that week off to prepare and be ready for the U.S. Open. So that would be my take. Any final things you want to say about the Memorial before we move on?
No, that's pretty much it.
All right. Well, let's talk a bit about what's going to happen in the European Tour with the Nordia Masters. It's going to be played at the Barsebäck Golf Club. Golf and Country Club is going to be in the Lodepinch in Sweden at 1.5 million euros. It's the first. It's going to be, if you want to see it, it's going to be on the Golf Channel Thursday through Friday from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. and 9 a.m. to noon. And then on Saturday and Sunday, it will be from 7 to 11:30 a.m. on Golf Channel. The defending champion is Matt Fitzpatrick, British Open champ Henrik Stenson, and BMW PGA champion recently crowned Alex Noren are playing their home event, giving the Nordia Masters two players from their top 10 in the world. Noren is already a two-time winner of this tournament. Stenson, he became an honorary member here at Barsebäck back in 2007. This is the 10th time this course has hosted a tournament, and the first since 2009. The course also hosted a Solheim Cup back in 2003. This tournament dates to 1991, when Colin Montgomery defeated City by the Setters by only one shot. Four major champions are among the winners of the Nordia Masters, Nick Faldo, Vijay Singh, Graham McDowell, and Adam Scott. Stenson will try to become the sixth Swedish winner in the history of the event. The other were Norris, of course, he was twice, just their partners, Richard Johnson, Peter Hansen, and Joachim Hagerman. So it's going to be an interesting tournament. Of course, it's a lot of the Swedes are going to be there, and all of the top players are in Mirfield Village in the Memorial with Jack. So the week after is going to be the Lioness Open.
Yeah, just a couple of notes here, too. The LPGA is going to have the ShopRite this week. Anna Nordqvist will be trying to make it three in a row after firing a final round 64 last year to defend the title that she won in 2015. And she also tied the scoring record, 17 under par, set by Annika Sorenstam in 1998 and then again in 2005. This event is held at the Stockton Seaview Hotel and Golf Club in Galloway, New Jersey, just across the bay from Atlantic City. The pros are playing for a total purse of $1.5 million, and they'll play just 54 holes, three rounds on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And then finally, on the previews here, Carlos, the Web.com Tour, the Rex Hospital Open, will be held on the TPC Wakefield Plantation Course in Raleigh, North Carolina, which was designed by Hale Irwin. Trey Mullinex was the 2016 winner. The total purse this week is $650,000, with $115,000 going to the winner. It was kind of unique. There was 12 spots up for grabs in a Monday qualifier this week, and they had 270 golfers on two different golf courses trying to qualify. It took like 7-6, 5-under to have a shot. Michael Schoolcraft won, was a medalist at one course, and T.J. Howell was a medalist at the other one. But all 12 spots got filled. They had 270 golfers show up for that, Carlos.
And one note, first note from the LPGA Tour, the ShopRite Classic, that's one of just 354 home events on the LPGA Tour schedule. Sonia Ryu, she, like I mentioned before, she ended her streak of 11 consecutive LPGA Tour finishes in the top 10 this past weekend at the LPGA Volvic when she tied for 56. She's in the field and will have a fourth straight chance to replace Lydia Ko at number one in the world. Lydia Ko and Arya Juntanen are not playing, so at the best chance that she will have in a while to take that number one in the world. And the LPGA Tour has not had a multiple winner so far in 12 tournaments this year. That's the second longest streak to start a season with not a multiple winner. In fact, in 1991 until the 16th event of the year. So let's see what happens. So far, South Korea has produced 6 units this year. The U.S. is next to 3, while Japan, Sweden, and China have 1 each. And one more note, which I found interesting and something that I like that the LPJ did, they had a fan Twitter poll to see who would earn the final sponsor extension. So they had all the fans voted, and it was Sharmila Nicolet, the one who won that fan Twitter poll, won that final sponsor extension. She won by 9 percentage points over Blair O'Neill. So it was really interesting, this, and really different, and I wish they could do that more to give some other players that see who the fans really want to see their return. Anyway, anything else you would like to add about our previews before we move on to our best news?
No, I pretty much covered everything I got, Carlos.
Alrighty, well, now the Power 5 news is going to be led by Fred, and you're going to talk about what everybody, for some reason, is talking on the world of golf, and that is Tiger Woods. I mean, yes, it's Tiger Woods, but go ahead, just say it. I just have something to say.
Yeah, Tiger, it's been kind of an eventful month for Tiger Woods. And no, he's not been swinging a golf club at a PGA Tour event, but he did undergo a fourth back surgery on April 20th and had said as recently as last week he was feeling pain-free and feeling better than he had for a long time. Tiger said in a statement last week, "It has been just over a month since I underwent fusion surgery on my back. It's hard to express how much better I feel. It was an instant nerve relief. I haven't felt this good in years. I could no longer live with the pain I had. We tried every possible non-surgical route, and nothing worked. I had good days and bad days, but the pain was usually there, and I couldn't do much. Even lying down hurt. I had nerve pain with anything I did and was at the end of my rope. The process leading up to my decision to have surgery was exhaustive. I consulted with specialists after weighing my options, that's when I decided to go to Texas to have the surgery." He went on, "But I want to say unequivocally, I want to play professional golf again. Presently, I'm not looking ahead. I can't twist for another 2.5 to 3 months. Right now, my sole focus is rehab and doing what the doctors tell me. I'm concentrating on short-term goals." So, the good news from this is that Tiger sincerely feels this last back surgery has ended his back problems. He still wants to play, but can't even begin to think about swinging a club until late this summer. In a new development that just hit the news yesterday, Tiger was stopped at 3 a.m. Sunday night in Jupiter by the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Department and charged with a DUI. In a statement released Monday night, Woods said alcohol was not a factor in his arrest, which he said stemmed from an unexpected reaction to prescription medicine, painkillers. In the police report filed, an officer found Tiger asleep in his car along the side of the road with the motor running and turn signal on. Tiger explained to the officer he took several different prescription medications, including Solrex, Vicodin, Torix, and Vioxx. And Carlos, I can tell you, Vicodin is bad stuff. And then if you're taking other stuff with it, I will not take Vicodin. I mean, I have to be like dying to try and take a Vicodin, because, I mean, it makes me crazy. When tested on a breathalyzer, he was not positive for any alcohol, but could not maintain balance and failed to properly walk a straight line. In a statement Monday evening, Wood said, "I understand the severity of what I did, and I take full responsibility for my actions. I want the public to know that alcohol was not involved. What happened was an unexpected reaction to prescribed medications. I didn't realize the mix of medications had affected me so strongly. I would like to apologize with all my heart to my family, friends, and the fans. I expect more from myself, too. I will do everything in my power to ensure this never happens again. I fully cooperated with law enforcement. I would like to personally thank the representatives of the Jupiter Police Department and the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office for their professionalism." So, Carlos, it just keeps getting deeper and deeper for Tiger. Now, maybe he's got his back fixed, but does he have a drug dependency to painkillers? hopefully this is a minor issue and can be dealt with swiftly and not become a factor going forward.
You know, that's where I see the problem, that it's not going to be a minor issue, even though to me it's a minor issue. And it's because there's so much people. I can still see all the memes and all that because of that photo that they took of him. And before they even get the facts, which is what really, I'm not going to say a word, but it really upsets me. It's the equal to that. But it really, before learning all the facts, which I wanted to see, why was he looking that way? Everybody, oh, he was drinking. Look, what? Oh, they were already condemning him. I mean, this isn't the most shocking DUI we have ever seen. He's just the latest, and of course he won't be the last. I know, to me, it doesn't necessarily will complete his downfall from right now being maybe the best player of his generation. It might throw some few endorsement deals, unfortunately. It shouldn't. Those few details that surfaced about his arrest near his Jupiter, Florida home, and after, like you said, he released a statement blaming it on prescription medication, but it's like good, at least for me, relief that, hey,
Carlos here. Carlos, we lost you. Or well, let's move on here. I'm going to move on and talk a little bit about the U.S. Open exemptions. We're coming up in a couple weeks here, the U.S. Open. And, of course, everybody's trying to qualify right now to get into the tournament.
Just in case, Fred, I'm back. So whenever
you're back. Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah. Go ahead and wrap up what you were saying. So let's go back and wrap up what you were saying then about Tiger. I'm sorry.
No, it's my call fell for some reason, so I apologize for that, but I am back now. But anyway, plenty have pontificated about the incident, focusing primarily on his wealth and expressing dismay at how he failed to call Uber or hire a driver. I mean, if it were only that simple, I'm not making excuses for him or anyone that has ever been arrested for DUI. But it's a stupid, really selfish act. But it's not one made by a brain filled with a rational thought, especially after what he was going through with those pain medications. We don't know right now if it's that he's addicted to it or if he just took it without knowing. Because if it's the first time, that I would say that he did it, because otherwise we have seen this reaction from him before. Yes, it's easy for people with money or a lot less money than him to make arrangements prior to parties or nights out that seem likely to produce a lot of drinking. But hey, he wasn't thinking about that. He didn't know. He already said he was not that way. And you should remember reading Tiger Woods magazine piece more than a decade ago, when he said, back then he was still owning the world of golf, but he was trying to find his place in the real world. That magazine said that it mentioned how whenever he flew somewhere, even overseas, he liked to drive the rental car because it made him feel like a normal person, at least for those few minutes that he was behind the wheel. Maybe driving still does that for him, as he's trying to figure out life after golf, because that's what he's facing right now, at least life after competitive golf at its highest level in his case. Of course, that will never excuse what he did. I mean, he didn't know, to me. You're going to report in a short while about Billy Horschel's wife revealing that she had gone to the rehab and was probably 1 year sober. This is not his case. But, there's no amount of power and money, no measure of the good life that ensures one would have to fight with this kind of things. And people are just too quick thinking this one side or the other. I take delight in seeing Woods arrested. And really bothers me. I mean, questioning even his intelligence. I don't remember the same reaction when Tony La Russa or broadcaster Al Michaels were charged with DUIs. They were drinking. It wasn't prescription medication. It was drinking. Maybe I just missed that. I don't remember that reaction, the same reaction. It's just because Tiger Woods. But, you know, he's battled with injuries with knees and back, has essentially removed him from the PGA Tour. Whether, like you say, he has a larger problem that he needs to confront is only known to him and maybe a handful of friends. I mean, given his privacy, it could be even a smaller group than that. But even if he does need to fight that battle, one in which there's a world of help at everyone's doorstep, of course, failing to call for help a second time is surely not the way to go. But it really, I don't like what people are still wrongfully condemning him before knowing all the details.
Well, I agree. We're going to talk about more about media jumping on stuff and bias and slanted reporting. But, you know, Tiger's never really had a drinking problem in the past that's ever surfaced or we ever knew about. But saying that, he's had a lot of time on his hands over the past couple of years, and who knows, you know, what he does when he's in the confines of his own home. But he's never been in public that way before that I've ever heard of or known of. It does make sense that given the problems that he's had with the pain over the past couple of years, that, you know, using opioids and those kind of things to kill the pain could become a problem. And Carlos, I mean, you can just go here in Toledo. I mean, I hear story after story after story of kids who, have taken opioids for some problem a doctor's prescribed them, and then they can't get off of them, and they get hooked to heroin and all kinds of stuff. And it all stems from painkillers. So, you know, I don't want to make this worse than it is, but you know, I really hope, I just sincerely hope that this is not a big deal, and this is just a one-time thing, a one-off, and he's got it under control, the back's okay, and you know, everything will be fine if he can get back to playing some golf and playing at a reasonable level. If not, you know, it's just another nail in the coffin. And as you said, Carlos, there's no medium ground with Tiger. It seems like people either hate him or they love him, and they're quick to go either way. So that I think, is what you're seeing. The people that don't like him just jump on it with both feet and to take even a more cautious stance and wait and see what happens. It's not the norm with Tiger.
Right. But anyway, we'll know more about this. I know, like you say, I'm also hoping this is something that goes quickly, but I don't think, like, we're going to be talking a little bit later on the practice bench. I don't think this is going to be the end of this, because he, just like the person that we're going to talk about later, is somebody that there's no middle ground with. But anyway, let's take a little bit about a story that just won't go away, and one that we reported on last week. Just 2 weeks after a New York Supreme Court judge denied in part a request from the PGA Tour for summary judgment in its ongoing legal battle with Vijay Singh, the Tour appealed that decision. On May 12th, Judge Eric Branson, as we said last week, partially denied the Tour's request for summary judgment regarding Singh's claims the circuit breached its implied covenant by suspending Singh for his use of deer antler spray before consulting with the WADA, and that the Tour officials made improper public statements regarding the decision's suspension. In its appeal, the lawyers for the Tour argued that Branson erroneously held that there is material fact dispute as to whether the Tour breached the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing by failing to conduct an appropriate investigation when it did not consult WADA and/or appreciate the information advanced by WADA concerning deer antler spray prior to issuing its suspension. Tour lawyers argue that no such implied obligation can exist as a matter of law, and in any event, Singh cannot establish that the Tour acted arbitrarily, irrationally, or in bad faith. Singh cannot establish that the Tour's public statement were made either of those ways. You know, Singh's attorney, Peter Ginsburg, countered with a letter to Branson late Friday requesting a conference to set a trial date. Ginsburg wrote, and I quote, "We respectfully believe both the Tours appeal has little chance of success, and because this lawsuit has been pending for so long, as a matter of fact, 4 years already, that the matter should not be sidetracked by the Tours action today." Singh admitted to using that deer antler spray. It's already documented, but it wasn't until after his suspension was announced that the Tour consulted with WADA, which had previously ruled the use of the deer antler spray was not a violation if there had been no field drops. The Tour does not command ongoing litigation, so we don't know for sure what they're trying to do. I mean, of course, they're trying to delay the inevitable. If Vijay Singh's lawsuit against the PGA Tour were falsehood, it would be officially on the clock. The PGA Tour is definitely trying to defend keeping all those dirty secrets they would have to air out about the punishment that they go around and having to do something that for them is unspeakable, and that is change. If they would have said, mea culpa, my bad, here's some money, Vijay, and here's my public apology, I think we wouldn't be talking about this 4 years after. But Fred, I can't wait to see when this desperate move by the PGA Tour gets dismissed. And like PGA's lawyer said, for once and for all, the PGA Tour will be asked something and they don't want to talk about it, but they will have to answer. I believe, really, a change will come soon after.
Yeah, I really just want this story to go away. I'm tired of hearing about it. I'm tired of talking about it. I'm just really sick of it. Vijay is stuck. You know, he's put his back up. He's going to go to court. He wants his day. He wants the PGA Tour to have to answer in court. And they don't want that. They want to get this thing settled. They've offered him a settlement, and he just doesn't want it. You know, he said, you know, you guys were not fair with me. You did this wrong. And so I don't know. It's going to go to court, Carlos. It's going to keep on going. We might be talking about it 2 years from now yet. So, hey, Carlos, it's U.S. Open time. 9,485 golfers entered the qualifying process for the 117th U.S. Open that will be held at Erin Hills outside of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, June 15th through 18th. Nearly 1,000 progressed from the 114 local qualifiers around the country. Thus, the second round of qualifying will see 980 golfers vying for one of the valued spots in the U.S. Open field. 10 locations across the United States will host sectional qualifying, as well as 2 locations internationally. Last year, 82 of the 156 players in the field at Oakmont earned berths via qualifying. On May 22nd, 3 players from Japan and Chan Kim from Arizona finished in the top 4 at Ono Golf Club in Japan to earn a tee time at Erin Hills. The second international qualifier was held at Walton Heath Golf Club in Surrey, England just yesterday. Aaron Rye, who has won 2 events on the European Challenge Tour this year, was the medalist at Surrey. Li Watong of China was runner-up and punched his ticket to the Open. Freshman Alexander LeVay will return to the U.S. Open, as will 2006 U.S. Amateur Champion Richie Ramsey. For LeVay, it will be his second appearance in a U.S. Open, while Ramsey will play in the U.S. Open for the first time in 10 years, and the first time as a professional. Andrew B. Johnson, always a fan favorite, made a hole-in-one on the second hole during his morning round, and then recorded a pair of eagles in the afternoon to earn his spot in the U.S. Open. Also qualifying in England, South Africans Oliver Becker, George Quetzi, and Brandon Stone, Frenchman Joel Stauder, and Englishman Eddie Pepperell, and Welshman Bradley Dredge. There was a 7-for-4 spot playoff that was required to determine the final spots as darkness fell. Paul Dunne, you remember him from Ireland, played so well in the Open Championship a couple of years ago at St. Andrews. He was a member of the 2015 GBNI Walker Cup team, and also South Africa's Thomas Aiken were the first to make it through the second hole of the playoff. Matt Wallace of England and Australia Wade Armsby joined them one hole later. Notables who failed to make the U.S. Open field via the qualifier at Walton Heath included 3-time major champion Padraig Harrington, 2009 PGA champion Whiten Yang, and 2010 U.S. Open runner-up Gregory Havre. On Monday, June the 5th, so that's Monday coming up right here after the memorial, the sectionals will be held in California, Florida, Georgia, Maryland, New Jersey, Ohio, Tennessee, Texas, and Washington to determine the final spots available in the field for the 2017 U.S. Open. So, Carlos, you can log on to, if you're interested in following it, log on to usopen.com/qualifying/sectional-html. If you just go to usopen.org, hit on the qualifying there, or go to the championships and then go to qualifying, you'll be able to get to the page and see the field and go through it, see where they're coming from, all the sectionals there, if you've got a favorite player that you're watching.
Hey, one of the most entertaining players in the women's game is leaving the LPGA. According to a Reuters report, Hannah Yatt is rescinding her LPGA membership and will return to play full-time in her native South Korea beginning next month. Yang's agency announced on Monday that Yang will begin playing on the KLPGA Tour in June. The 25-year-old Yang is ranked 10th in the world and joined the LPGA Tour back in 2015. Prior to playing in the LPGA, she competed in the KLPGA where she won 8 titles from 2012 to 2015. She was also named Player of the Year on top of the money list back in 2013. She was quickly becoming a star on the rise and expected to contend for the world top rank. She won last year 3 times last season and added a 4th to Women's Australian Open this year in February. She quickly became known for her post-victory celebrations, but the only unfortunate issue in her career was that she struggled to distance herself from a freak accident involving her father and fellow LPGA star Ingi Chun. Last year, March of 2016, Yang's father dropped a travel bag down an escalator at the Singapore airport that crashed into Chun. Chun then withdrew from the LPGA event held that week in Singapore, one that Yang went on to win. She celebrated with a Beyoncé-style dance on the 18th green that many Korean fans viewed as disrespectful, given the airport collision that knocked out one of her chief competitors. In subsequent press conference, you could see Yang was asked about the incident and she would break down in tears. She struggled to cope with that backlash. She returned to Korea for this period last year following the incident, where she was at one point hospitalized for various ailments, reportedly anemia, headaches, vomiting, and difficult sleeping. At the LPGA Tour stop in South Korea last October, the KB Hana Bank Championship security had to be called to deal with a spectator after he was verbally abusive to Yang while she was thanking the crowd after her round. She didn't record a top 10 finish following her Singapore win until the Marathon Classic in July. I mean, it's she has made 4 starts in the U.S. this year, highlighted by T5 at the Bank of Hope Founders Cup, but has not placed since losing to Sydney Clanton in the opening round of the Lorena Ochoa match. Yeah, I think she to overlook this dramatic and stressful series of events and assume it had something to do with her decision to leave the LPGA, but in a press conference that she had in Seoul, she said her choice has nothing to do with that incident. She said that it's because she found something more precious than golf. Fred, as I always say, not everything in life is about money and success, and we keep seeing more and more examples of this. This is just the latest. By being back in South Korea, she will now spend more time with her mother, and she will be returning to a tour where, like I said before, in 2013, she was the money leader. So, Fred, success can feel like home to you.
Yeah, you know, traveling the world and being a golf nomad is just not for everyone. You know, I've said it before, you know, jumping in planes and being in a strange country, I mean, you know, if you don't, you know, she's Korean, if she doesn't speak that much English, it would be tough, you know. If you or I were traveling around in a country where we didn't speak the language, that would become tedious. I'm sure it would. So, good luck for her, whatever she chooses to do. Carlos, we got kind of there's a lot of background noise there. I don't know if you can hear that or not, but there's a lot of background noise coming in. Billy Horschel's wife announced last week that she has been dealing with alcohol addiction, and Horschel has been trying to help her and work through that for the last few years. 2 weeks ago, Billy Horschel won the AT&T Byron Nelson, and during his post-round interview, he referred to personal struggles that he had to deal with over the past couple of years since he had won both the BMW and the Tour Championship the final 2 weeks in the 2014 FedEx Cup playoffs and the FedEx Cup. The next day, after he won the Byron Nelson, Brittany, his wife, posted a tweet about her alcohol addiction. Billy answered questions about his wife's social media announcement last week at the Dean in DeLuca. Brittany revealed that she had spent more than 2 months at a treatment center last year, and just last weekend marked the one-year anniversary of her sobriety. Horschel had told his wife that the decision to make her struggle public was up to her. "I obviously mentioned something about it last year, but we can dip, dive, and dodge around these questions, no problem, and we can wait until you're ready," Horschel told his wife. Carlos, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Man, the background noise is horrendous. Can you hear that?
No. At least
I'm okay. It's really quiet while you're here, while you're there. Did you have the mute button on?
No.
Don't do that.
No, I don't have it.
Okay, it was tremendous, tremendous background noise. So, I'll continue on here. He told his wife that the decision to make her struggles public was up to her. I obviously mentioned something about it the last year, but we can, you know. And so he left it up to her. And last week she told him, "No, I'm ready to share a story and start helping people." In a prepared message, Horschel read, "You really never know what is going on in someone's life, and that has certainly been true this last year for me. There are so many families out here who struggle with a very variety of issues. We're not any different aside from being more in the public eye, which provides us with an opportunity to speak out about the very real struggles of battling addiction. It can be a very lonely disease, and there's a stigma out there that leads many not to ask or accept the help they need. My wife and I hope that sharing our story will help other people who are either struggling with addiction or are their loved ones. We look forward to sharing more in the future." Brittany had written that her husband respectfully left her to answer it however she wanted, if at all. "However, to not answer would not only be unfair to him, but to my own integrity." She added that her husband took full responsibility taking care of their first child, moving to a new home, and competing on the tour while she was getting treatment. "He silently battled through, with support from family and close friends, a very sad, scary, and trying time." Carlos, it can be difficult enough making five-footers when your mind is somewhere else. It's damn impossible. Horschel and his wife, Brittany, have been married more than 6 years. They have children. Billy said the past year has been, since she's gone through the treatment, has been one of the most enjoyable in their marriage. "My wife is 1 year sober. The journey is not over. It never will be. But we're on the right path, and every day we have challenges, just like everyone else in the world. We're just going day by day and staying on the path God has put in front of us." Carlos, these are the normal trials and tribulations of real life that professional golfers, just like every other family in the world, deal with every day. It's a constant struggle. It appears they're coming out the other side, and we wish Brittany and Billy and their family all the best.
Definitely. That's one more example that we don't know what's going on behind in the private life of all golfers. We sometimes see them struggling. We just don't know why. There are some things behind that we should first, like I was saying about Tiger, we should first corroborate everything before making any assumptions into it. And definitely, I second that, and we wish them the best. Hopefully, Bradley Beatty can be back. I mean, he was very close to that win lately. So, hey, hopefully he'll be, and he won recently. And who knows? Maybe he'll have a great summer and maybe make the President's Cup. Hey, Top Golf is out to top itself. As part of a deal announced earlier this month, the company, known for its popular golfing entertainment complexes, revealed its plans to make golf simulator is a growing part of its customer experience. The move is tied to a new partnership between Topgolf and Full Swing Golf, whose simulators Topgolf will use as it seeks to expand a new concept called Topgolf Swing Suite Launch. The first Topgolf Swing Suite, equipped with two simulators, lounge seating, and high-def televisions, opened in January at the Four Seasons Hotel in Houston. I mean, you can walk in and play, or the swing suite can be reserved for groups up to 15. Topgolf plans to open dozens of new swing suites around the country in the next few years, all of them powered by Full Swing simulator technology. Topgolf views the suites as opportunities to reach people who might not otherwise visit their brick-and-mortar locations. Ron Powers, Topgolf's chief digital office, said in a release, "The game of golf can be enjoyed in many different forms, whether on a course, at a Topgolf venue, at home, or on your phone." Powers said that the partnership with Full Swing signifies their commitment to the growing Topgolf suite business, and they look forward to expanding Topgolf's footprint with other entertainment venues. The partnership also represents a business alliance between two growing brands in the golf industry, better known in recent years for its struggles, as evidenced by the closures of big box golf retailers and the exit of major names like Nike from the golf equipment business. As part of the deal, Topgolf has made what has described as a strategic investment in Full Swing. Financial terms of that transaction were not immediately disclosed. Fred, those swing suites will be coming to entertainment facilities all over the world. Combining that excitement of the Topgolf with exceptional service, great food and beverage. I mean, if you haven't been there, it's an incredible sports and entertainment experience. And this is just going to enhance it.
Yeah, I've not had I've not been able to get to a Topgolf facility yet. I want to get one soon. It just hasn't worked out. But they seem to have everything figured out, and their company is definitely growing. So probably should have bought stock in that baby, a couple years ago when they were really getting going.
Yes, you should have. That's not in your portfolio, that was late. Hey, with that, we'll wrap up our par 5 news. We took a bogey, and we went par 6 this time, so we hope you enjoyed it. But now it's time for our practice range. Every week, Fred and I pick a topic. And this week, oh man, we're going to talk about media and how some media people get some labels out. And Fred, I'm just going to let you talk first and try to see how I can comment fair and square.
Well, you know, you kind of started the discussion. We were talking about Tiger of the media and social media people jumping to conclusions about Tiger Woods. Well, this is a little different, but similar. I started this thing out by saying, you know, has everyone gone crazy? Does the media need to push a non-Trump agenda in sports? You know, are we against Champions Tour players Rocco Media and Fred Funk? Are they regarded as sexist because they support the president? It's just ludicrous, this article that this woman wrote. The media and President Trump have been embroiled in a do-or-die fight to the finish battle for truth or their perception of the truth in the mainstream media. USA Today's Christine Brennan brought the negative press to the Champions Tour last week as the seniors were in D.C. at Trump National for the Senior PGA Championship. She took the opportunity to take a shot at Champions Tour players Fred Funk and Rocco Media, as well as President Trump. Brennan began her onslaught of Rocco Media and Fred Funk by asking them how they could support Trump's blatant sexist comments. She then wrote that Funk made derogatory sexist remarks, quoting, and so I quote from her article here, "Unfortunately, Funk wasn't in the interview room for 5 minutes when he uttered a sexist remark. He was joking about how he gets new fairway medals every birthday to keep up with the lengthening golf courses and said, 'I feel like I should be on the ladies' tour right now.' That seems to be a pretty big stretch for me as a sexist comment. But Brennan then went on. He immediately caught himself with another attempt at humor. I didn't mean that in a derogatory sense, not at all. Just because Annika outdrove me, I'm a little bitter, but no. But no, indeed. It was fascinating that those blatantly sexist words came so easily to him. They tumbled off his tongue, as if he had said them 100 times before. Perhaps this was the first time, but it sure didn't sound like it. This was a man who sounded quite comfortable delivering a snide remark about women's golf. This was the man with Trump's name over his heart. This is just so inflammatory. I mean, I cannot believe it. I mean, do you see how Brennan's using the phrase about comparing the shortness of his golf game to the ladies and then tying it to Trump? If that's not slanted journalism, I just don't know what is. Why are we allowing this type of obviously biased writing in our media? Carlos, I got to say, I mean, I've said this before on the show. I've been wary of anything that I see on television news since the mid-70s. It's just, you can look at any, I don't care what you look at. Now today it's Fox Sports, Fox News versus MSN or CNN or, you know, it's just, you have to know where they're coming from, what agenda they're trying to push. But why do current day journalists think they have the right and the obligation to force their views through their writing? Fred Funk rebutted Christine Brennan's post in USA Today, calling him sexist because he's a Trump supporter, on Morning Read. Funk was invited by Morning Read to post a rebuttal to the scathing article, and he wrote an eloquent piece, and I'm going to quote from it. My experience with the media in my 30-year career generally has been fantastic, so when I saw the hatchet job by USA Today's Christine Brennan, I was more than dismayed. I was perplexed and angry. I was portrayed by Brennan as sexist and clearly not in tune with her agenda. I caught a glance of Brennan sitting in the audience in my pre-tournament interview on Wednesday for the Senior PGA Championship at Trump National. Although I had never met her, I had read many of her articles, and I suspected that she would attempt to portray me in a negative light. After some questions about my relationship with President Donald Trump, Brennan asked me why I was representing the Trump name on my chest. I don't mind that I support Trump, and she doesn't. That doesn't bother me at all. However, I am extremely bothered by the fact that Brennan has pushed others towards questioning my relationship with Annika and the LPGA. That really hurt. She created an image as if I'm a man who disrespects Annika and the LPGA. I don't know how she could even validate that. I'm livid about that. So, Carlos, I'm going to stop right there, let you jump in here, and you can comment on those kind of things. I got a little bit more here. That whole thing just drives me nuts. I just didn't like it. I had a note from one of the other golf writers that was at the tournament and said it was really an awkward situation. Everyone was really not happy with Brennan the way she pursued the whole line of questioning and how she wrote her article, Carlos.
If you're sick and tired of the BJ Singh piece of news, I am sick and tired of the people from the media who takes this kind of approach. I mean, you have to be politically correct and all that. I really hate that. I mean, if you say one thing one way or another, there's going to be somebody that is going to be upset about it. I mean, and this is going to shock you all, but, you know, men are better than at sports than women. Men are better at women than women running, jumping, shooting, boxing, lifting weights, fighting, catching, swimming, whatever any physical sport acting you can possibly imagine. There's not a single sport that has ever been created that women are better than men. And that's not being sexist. That is biology. That's science. Arguing that women are better than men in any sport is most assuredly the very definition of fake sports news. Now, that doesn't mean that every man is better than every woman at every sport. That's plainly not true. Okay? Many female golfers, I mean, most of them, would destroy me, for instance, on the golf course. That's for sure. But it's most assuredly, it's not sexist for a men's pro golfer to say that he's better than female pro golfers. I mean, that's just biology. That's the way it is. And before saying this, I might be now considered sexist. While I've always said, and it's a record here, that we have always defended the LPGA as a great turn, as a great tour, I, for once, have, you have heard me said it before, it's my favorite kind of tour because of all the players there, the way they play, all the top players being there. I have never, ever been sexist about anything, you know. And I really have respected Christine Brennan's reporting before, but to me this is a vintage PC Bromani column. I mean, by that I mean the author of the column knew exactly what she or he or she, in this case, was going to write, which is a journey at arguing for inclusiveness and social justice warring before she actually done any work at all. I mean, I'm just going to talk about two parts of the column because I can go on and explain each one of them. But let's take the headline for starters. You know, the headline said senior PGA players are like Trump kind of crowd. By and large, this may be true since all white guys tend to vote Republican. Of course, many senior PGA players might well be huge Democrats or actual conservatives and find Trump's presidency distasteful. But that doesn't matter. Let's go ahead and paint with a broad brush while getting Donald Trump's name in the headline for SEO purposes, of course. When you go Google and put Donald Trump, and then it's going to appear senior PGA players are Trump's kind of crowd, of course you're going to attract some people to read it. At this point, let me ask you one interesting question. If he would have gone on to say, Freak Nick in Atlanta back in the day, and written an article headlined, Freak Nick attendees are Obama's kind of crowd, after all, I mean, young black people in Atlanta overwhelmingly voted for Obama, just like presumably old white golfers overwhelmingly vote for Trump. It's the same thing, right? But that headline wouldn't have been written because everybody knows that judging large groups of people based on the color of their skin is racist, unless the people you're judging, of course, are white. Moving right along, which is the second point I want to make, here's the opening paragraph, and I'm going to read it to you. It says, there's no sport as intrinsically linked to Donald Trump as the game of golf. It's only the sport Trump plays, and he plays it every chance he gets. He owns courses around the world, and this year alone, two of them will host major championships, the U.S. Open, the U.S. Women's Open in New Jersey in July, and this week in KitchenAid Senior PGA Championship at Trump National Golf Club near Washington, D.C. You know, in the opening sentence, she lets you know that this is not a column about golf or golfers. It's a column about Donald Trump. There's literally no sports story angle here at all in that opening paragraph. And she is a sports writer in a sports column. Donald Trump, like millions of other men and women in the country in his 70s, plays only one sport, golf. This is not a unique fact about Trump or other men and women his age. In fact, if Trump played pickup basketball or baseball or hockey at age 70, it would be pretty uncommon, right? I would read the hell out of an article about Donald Trump pickup baller. In fact, I won those pickup games televised. The point here is pretty simple. Other than tennis, just about every man in his 70s who wants to play a sport plays golf. The fact that Trump, a billionaire, owns golf courses is not particularly big news either. It has been discussed a great deal already in his presidency, but he had them before he became president. So what you have here, based on the headline and opening paragraph, is a clear piece of agenda journalism. Before she's even asked a question, you can already divine the intent of the column. It's designed to disparage Donald Trump and the men who support it. So, really, this was a biased column trying to go with an agenda, to try to gain some, I don't know, like I said, it should have been something that she wanted to get through there, social justice, inclusiveness, whatever it is, but really, and anybody who knows me, I'm not sexist. best. I love the women's gaming everywhere. But this just went too far for it. And I don't know. I was just disgusted about it.
Yeah. Hey, Carlos, I got to ask you a question. We're down here to almost our 90 minutes. Did you? We have more time.
We have some more time, so you can keep going.
Okay. Well, let me wrap this up here. I agree with everything you said. And in a related piece, Mark Canizero posted a piece in the New York Post extolling the LPGA and the USGA for holding a women's major at a Donald Trump course, which, of course, the USGA is going to host the U.S. Open at Trump Bedminster here next month. And the headline, again, the headline, Golf failed women in putting U.S. Open at Trump course. So, you know, when Donald Trump was in Europe attending the presidential business, and Canizero seemed more perturbed that Mike did. They held a media day for the U.S. Women's Open at Trump Bedminster, and Canizero was there. And so he seemed more perturbed that Mike Davis of USGA and the three women professionals, Lydia Ko, Brittany Lynchcombe, and Christy Kerr, who attended the media day, for not taking the bait and allowing themselves to be grilled by a professional interview. He dredges up old news from years ago about Trump making lewd sexual comments. The voting public heard all this stuff and voted for Trump anyway. Why in the world is he bringing up all this stuff again, and of all places, at U.S. Women's Golf Media Day, just because the Trump family owns the course? Carlos, this, along with the stuff that Brennan did, and just like you referred to about gaining SEO, this is all about newspapers losing readership and trying to have some sensational journalism, trying to do anything they can to bring eyeballs to their columns. It's a lot of ado about nothing. And I just shame on these large publications, shame on both of these writers who know better. These are experienced professional sports writers. I don't get it, Carlos. I mean, I get it. I know what they're doing, but I sure as hell don't like it.
Totally. I have to agree with you. And I'm sorry, they're great writers, but they're missing the mark. And like you say, it's sickening that all we have to do is just get a name of Donald Trump right now, and that's just because I need to gain some viewership or something. I mean, that really tells me we're losing really the talent to bring the top news really the proper way to gain viewership. So it's, to me, sickening, really sickening that way.
I got a question for you before we get away from this. Do you know where Christine Brennan lives?
Don't tell me it's Ohio.
Huh?
It's Ohio?
Better than that. Better than that.
Really? Toledo?
Toledo, Ohio.
It's just your neighbor. You have problems. I would have gone to her house and talked to her.
I've never met her, but she lives here in town somewhere.
Oh man, you're gonna have trouble because now when she learns that she has said what we have said to her, she just goes to your house and talk to you. Right, sexist, you know, he's just trying to talk.
I'm sexist.
Yeah,
I'm
and you're Trump
yep.
kind of proud, too. You know?
Yes, exactly. I'm a deplorable. Yeah. I am a deplorable, actually.
Oh, man, this is ridiculous. But anyway, with that, we'll wrap up our practice range, and we're going to make the disclaimer, we are not sexist. We love women and their sports, and the LPGA here, they know how much we have promoted them, and, you know, we have had Michael Wan, we had Craig Cam before many times, and I mean,
we've had a lot of LPGA players.
Yeah.
We're going to have more, and we love the LPGA for sure. It's just, you know, the whole thing is just, it's just out of control. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, so I agree. Hey, let's move on and say our final putts, and I'm going to start as usual. There's the top off-the-range Audi Q7 on sale with 80,000 miles on the clock, and if you check the logbook, you'll find that one, what's his name, Rory McIlroy, was the previous owner, I mean, not the immediate previous owners, of course, but it may be a 3.0 liter beast, but it's now 6 years old, so well past its sell-by date in Warren's terms. Mark Morgan of Morgan's Cars told Sunday Life, and I quote, "It was bought from Ag News, and it was previously owned by Rory McIlroy and then another lady before we bought it." End of quote. You know, this 6-year-old 3.0 liter car with 80,000 miles on the clock has already attracted plenty of interest. Mark added that people have already been cracking jokes about the motor's famous past owner, with one quipping, "You better shake the seats because apparently you've got a hole in one." They started laughing with that, but I took the liberty to check the classifieds in News Now, which is a famous newspaper there in the UK and in Ireland. And in Northern Ireland, lo and behold, I found the one with the title, and it says used Audi Q7 3.0 TDI Quattro S-Line ex Rory McIlroy in Warren Point. So they see, it's not only Christian Brennan trying to use famous names to extract this. They put ex Rory McIlroy, even though it was 2 owners ago. They listed the price at £21,995. And News Now is famous for rating the cars there, and they said they rated it as a bit pricey. I guess Morgan Cars are trying to get a ride along the McIlroy story name, and so that's a little off. Well, best of luck to whoever buys it. Hey, and finally, Japan's Ai Miyasato said she has decided to quit the LPGA at the end of the season because she lost her motivation for the sport after years of struggling to win a game. Miyasato, who was ranked number one and captured 25 professional titles during her career, has not won a tournament in 5 years and said a lack of success has diminished her drive to keep going. There were rumors in the Japanese media that Miyasato was retiring because she was getting married, but the 31-year-old said she has no plans to tie the knot, and her real reason for quitting was somewhere less romantic. I remember women's golf had been dominated by Annika Sørensen, Lorena Ochoa in the years prior to Ochoa's retirement from full-time golf in April of 2010. Miyasato was in her prime that year. She won 4 of the first 9 LPGA Tour events she played. Her 9 LPGA Tour victories all came between 2009 and 2012, including 5 in 2010 when she was number one 3 times for a total of 11 weeks. Miyasato doesn't have a major title, Fred, but she's only one of 9 players to ever make it to number one since the Women's World Golf Rankings were introduced in 2006. It's really sad that she has been for so long, you know, not successful after being such a great player in her prime time. But of course, you know, father time reaches us, and unfortunately we won't be seeing more from her after this year.
Yeah, she was a really good player for several years back there, you know, 8-9 years ago. But that's just what happens. Hey, Carlos, last couple things here tonight. We know President Trump was in Europe last week meeting with leaders, but what was former President Obama doing in Europe? Well, he was doing a speaking engagement where he was at a 2,000 pound per head charity dinner in Edinburgh, and while he was there, he decided to take a few divots out of the old sod. He got to play St. Andrews a little bit. The press wasn't allowed, but there were several cell phones snapping pics and as he made his way around the old course. You know, we talk about sometimes life gets in the way and we don't know what's going on with the families and the backgrounds of professional golfers. Ron Green Jr., who we've had on the show a couple times, has an excellent piece in Global Golf Post this week. Came out yesterday. If you haven't seen it, log on. Go check out Global Golf Post. You know, we talked about family problems Billy Horschel has been facing and how it's affecting his on-course performance. There's a lot of other golfers that have had things happen, and Green does a good job of showing the insight and compassion and empathy for the problems professional golfers endure. Maybe he could give some writing lessons to Christine Brennan and Mark Cannizzaro. And that's all I have for tonight, Carlos.
Yeah, I won't talk anymore about those franchises. It's just awesome stuff. Hey, well, Bag Niners, that wraps up another week of the Bag Niner Report. Thank you for listening. It's always our pleasure to bring you the latest on the world of golf. Special thanks to our BAG, Jim Sullivan, the tournament director, for the Memorial Tournament. Don't forget to join us again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on Buffett Radio. Or if you missed it, check it out on iTunes or TuneIn. Or you can always see us now on Roku TV. And if you haven't done so, follow this show on Twitter or ID is at Back9Report with the number 9 in the middle. My name is Carlos Torres, along with Fred Alvader. We wish you to be happy, be blessed, and enjoy the great game of golf. Happy golfing, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Here, try my jumbo breakfast platter with scrambled eggs, 8 mini pancakes, hash brown, and bacon or sausage for just $2.99.
$2.99? Shut the front door.
Of the van or... Only at Jack in the Box. Limited time only at participating restaurants.
Honey, where'd you get the projector?
Work. See, we've got to look at 12 car sites to find our new car.
Well, I just went to Capital One's Auto Navigator site and found our perfect car. It's 3 miles away.
What about financing?
Already done. We're pre-qualified and can see our rate and monthly payment all without affecting our credit scores.
Wow, that was easy. But now I got to get this back to the office.
Find and finance the car you want. Visit CapitalOne.com/AutoNavigator today. Subject to credit approval. Terms and conditions apply. Final terms may change. Vehicles sold by eligible dealers and are subject to availability. Offered by Capital One NA.